I found it fascinating how culture influences language, how language influences culture.
Post editors, MT engineers, P consultants, here are the skills you need.
Netflix reportedly spent $500 million on original Korean programming in 2021 alone.
And welcome everybody to another episode of SlaterPod. Hi there, Esther.
Hi, Florian.
So today's guest is Felix Laumann, the CEO of a startup in the natural language processing space. And yes, his startup is called Neural Space. So natural language in space, Neural Space. So he is, so Neural Space is a platform for low resource languages, a topic we've also discussed. But yeah, I'll let Felix do the pitch, the nutshell introduction, etc. It's quite techy, of course, and they just raised a round recently. So looking forward to talking to Felix. First, again, I really want to call people to action. Please go to clearglobal.org, donate, and support their efforts in Ukraine and the border regions. So if you go there, they will send teams to the borders to find out what the language and communication needs are of the people affected. They will do pro bono translation for local orgs who are the first responders for people on the move. I mean, there's, as far as I can read now from the BBC, there's like 2 million people already crossing or have crossed the border. So there's so much activity going on at the border. So, they will clearly translate into all relevant languages, key documents that help people. And conduct research and communication needs. So there's lots of kind of first things that need to get set up, and they need funds for that. This is must be one of the biggest waves of refugees ever. And so very sad, but let's try to support that via Clear Global from the language industry. I think it's a very valuable, of course, initiative, and they need the funds right now. I've also chatted with Jan Hendricks from Beluga on LinkedIn. I meant to get back to him. They're setting up something also with Lock Launcher. They're looking at things from how they can support linguists that are being affected, right? Businesses evaporating for, Ukrainian, Russian languages. And so they see how they maybe can potentially cushion that blow, or at least kind of put the word out that maybe potential buyers could offer some work. And of course, now there's remote work available. So maybe some linguists that, have seen their work disappear on the linguistic side, they could potentially find work elsewhere on the remote. We all know that translators and linguists are very clever, very smart people that can do other work as well.
Highly adaptable. Yeah.
Highly adaptable. I mean, a lot of people here at Slater have originally a career in the language, well, on the production side of things as well. All right. So again, just head over to clearglobal.org/donate and, do what you can. On our side, we have SlaterCon Remote coming up next week. Are you ready, Esther?
Yes.
I am emphatically not ready.
if I'm not ready, I'm definitely looking forward to it. So how about that?
That's right. Okay. Good. You got a couple of panels to manage, and now I'm giving the presentation still as usual. It's in a state of disarray, and I need to put my slides together. So we have the Australia leg of the conference. So that's where Anna is going to talk about some of the key trends. And then next up, we have Grant Straker from Straker Translations. Not on the pod, first on SlaterCon Remote. Looking forward to that. Then we have a media localization panel with head of localization of Astro and of our CEO, Dion Wiggins from CTO of Omniscient. And then Andrew is going to moderate this from our side. Mm-hmm. Then telehealth. So Tia Dieterich, who we had on the pod from 2M Language Services, she's going to participate there together with Dieter from Boost Lingo and Yuehu, who is the Director of Transcultural and Language Service, and Narun Vilip, Aboriginal Support Unit, Northern Health. So that's going to be a very Aussie-specific panel.
There's basically two complete conferences.
It's two complete conferences. It's a mega conference. Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Crammed into one for our friends in Australia. Then we have Melanie Hiwei, who's the manager of product localization at Atlassian, and she's going to give a presentation on like enterprise lock. Then we have multilingual events panel with Interprefy, Simulink International, Encore Event Technologies Asia, and our good Andrew again, so he's going to be super, super busy. And then we're heading into the next session. Again, I'll give the bullish case for the language industry. You're managing the transcreation panel, or hosting the transcreation panel, rather, right? Together with, tell us a bit more about who's on the panel there. It's Laura. Sorry, let me just tell a bit more. So Laura from Supertext, Nina Suttler, Hovdar, transcreation experts, Lindsay Hong from Locaria, and Esther herself. And you, transcreation. And then I'm quite pleased about Cyril Dobrinsky, the CEO of Deluxe.
Yeah. He's quite a new CEO as well, isn't he? Sort of two years, maybe, now?
2 years, yeah. So, you know, talking about streaming, how the landscape's evolving there, demand, etc. Very, very interesting. And then there's going to be a break with Fidel Tech, where Andrew is also managing that or hosting that. Then we got Nick McMahon, ULG CEO, doing a presentation, Salesforce AI, Xiong Chiming, and then Elevation of the Localization Manager with Intento. We got Esri, Nike, Gap, and again, Andrew. And then Coursera, localization program manager, Nora Duong from Coursera, talking about e-learning localization at Coursera and how they measure localization success. So now you know everything that's going on at SlaterCon Remote, and we're on minute six. So thank you so much for bearing with us, but don't miss this conference, all right? Today, we'll talk about Transline, Zoo Digital, Verbit briefly, and then post-editing skills. But first, Transline, German LSP, quite large, and now they have a new owner. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, they do. This is, I like writing about this, actually. It was quite an interesting one. So we had Transline in Germany, like you said, swapping private equity backers. So Transline was already majority owned by a private equity firm, an Austrian firm called Lead Equities Group. Since 2014, so Lead Equities has sold their stake, its investment in Transline, to a different investment firm, a German publicly traded investment firm called Bluecap. So this all happened on March the 4th. So it's a 74% stake, specifically, that Bluecap has taken over. Mm-hmm. 74% stake in Transline, as well as the five subsidiaries of Transline. And Transline Group's founder and CEO, Dr. Wolfgang Sturz, he also retains this significant minority stake of the remainder. The operational management actually is intending to purchase around a 5% stake, apparently, from Bluecap in the next few months. So they will also must have
skin in the game.
Skin in the game. Yeah, that's a good way of saying it. So Bluecap, they put out a press release announcing this acquisition as well, and said that the purchase price for Transline, although not specifically disclosed in numerical terms, they said it was in the lower third of the double-digit million range. So that gives you some kind of indication of the purchase price there. And interestingly, I mean, there's a lot of, maybe not unsurprisingly, there's a lot of focus on sort of talking about M&A, buy and build strategy. So we spoke to Katja Schabert, who's the CEO of Transline Deutschland, and she was saying Bluecap's going to support Transline, obviously, both in terms of their organic growth and their acquisitive growth strategy, which is still focused on the DACH region. That remains unchanged. Bluecap itself is heavily focused on that region, and they, you know, have a particular interest in companies that work on production processes for and services relating to industrially manufactured goods. So it's this kind of heavy industry focus, which you might expect from an investor in that particular region. But interestingly, then, you know, coming into the translation market for the first time via this acquisition of Transline, Bluecap's talking a little bit about the translation market, how they see things. So they're saying, you know, it's very fragmented and therefore it's subject to strong consolidation pressure, which they see as creating significant growth opportunities via buy and build. Transline, you know, you can expect more M&A coming out of them as well. They've already done a little bit of M&A in the previous years. Shaba Katia said that she was, that Transline's already talking to a few different, you know, small and medium-sized translation service providers in the region, and that we should expect more news to come out of it, Transline, maybe even this year in 2022. So they're currently around 20 million, I think 20, 21 million euros, so approximately $24 million. So actually, fun fact, they are the largest of the challengers in the Language Service Provider Index.
Threshold. Okay.
Well, the threshold for qualifying as a leader is $25 million. So, you know, unfortunately, the euro to dollar exchange rate didn't quite allow Transline to be qualified as an LSPI leader this year. But they're, you know, obviously in that ballpark. And they are the fourth largest LSP headquartered in Germany. So behind, other rivals, Kern, apostrophe, T-Works. Had a pretty good solid growth rate from 2020 of more than 15%. So that's what's been happening at Transline.
I find it interesting, BlueCap, just the business model of that company, because they also have, they posted revenue. So they're publicly traded buying private companies. And then if you go to their website, their approach is, they say BlueCap's approach, buy, transform, and sell. It's not just the management company. It seems like they consolidate the revenues of the companies they own into their
top line.
In their top line, right? So
they're like 300 million euros top line. BlueCap is.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, actually, Transline is not an insignificant part of that portfolio.
It's not an insignificant part. Mm. And I'm reading, so there's a fact sheet that says revenues were 175 million going to 2018, up to 2019 was 225, then 232, and EBITDA was like from 21, 15 to 34. Yeah, so it's not an insignificant part. But right, like anybody who, they have a ton of information, of course, on the internets, because they're publicly listed. So head in there and read up on it. So next up is MediaLock. Yeah, tell us more. In Korea, not Germany, but Korea.
Yeah, in the UK. So Zoo Digital, publicly traded in the UK, this week announced that they have taken a majority share in a company based in Korea. So Zoo Digital, they acquired a 51% stake in WhatsUp Pro, and they simultaneously launched Zoo Korea. So they're basically using that as a platform to launch Zoo Korea. You might remember they did something quite similar about 6 months ago when they launched Zoo Turkey. So Zoo also made a strategic investment in a company in Turkey called Aris Media about 6 months ago. And it seems to be sort of a pattern that they're developing now to kind of launch these international hubs in strategic locations.
So hang on. So they're buying like their partners or vendors, or like their in-country partners or vendors?
I mean, I think it would depend on a case-by-case basis, but I can't remember too much about Ares, but certainly WhatsUp Pro is a long-term partner of Zoo. So, yeah, they would have collaborated on Korean projects in the past, for sure. So WhatsUp Pro now is focused on Korean language services. So that would include subtitling, dubbing, quality control, media services, for media entertainment customers, so for movies and dramas, documentaries, and video games, apparently. They work for some video game customers also. But the logic here is for Zoo to gain, you know, in-territory capacity for localization to and from Korean. Zoo obviously provided some analysis, or at least their take on the market for media localization in Korea. They basically said, you know, Korean content is among the most watched in the world. And we all know about Squid Game and the success that had recently. But they're saying, you know, it goes obviously goes beyond that. And the idea here is to enable Zoo's customers to basically bring local language shows and movies to new global audiences. So coming out of Korea, but then also, you know, expanding the viewership in Korea for non-Korean original content also. And they threw out some stats as well from some of the leading streaming providers. So Zoo said in APAC, Disney Plus has announced plans to create more than 50 Asia-Pacific original productions by 2023. And they only launched in the region, I guess, in 2021, because Disney Plus was quite new. And then Netflix reportedly spent $500 million on original Korean programming in 2021 alone. I mean, some of that will have gone on, probably went on Squid Game itself. But yeah, they've got a budget there for developing Korean original programs as well. So yeah, that's what Zoo's been up to in Korea.
And then Verbit, touching briefly on that. So remember the multilingual transcription captioning company that raised I don't know, how much did they raise? $500 million?
They raised $250 million in one round, but total amount raised to date is $550 million.
Now they bought a company called Take Note.
Yeah, I really like the company name. I was like, oh, it's a transcription provider and it's called Take Note.
Take Note, yes.
Anyway, you should keep the brand, in my view.
Maybe they rebrand into Take Note. So that company, but this is not a very large company, right? Because we did some digging and they don't have to post their full financials.
Take Note is UK headquartered, but they don't have a requirement to report like full accounts every year. So, I mean, there's a number of reasons for exemption, but generally it means that you generate revenues of less than £10 million.
Okay. So yeah, I mean, thing is, Verbit raised a ton of money to do M&A, and that's what they're doing right now. And if you're a transcription company, you know, a giant exit route remains for you to sell to Verbit. Doing some corporate development here for our friends at Verbit. very briefly, want to bring up an article people need to go and read about post editors, MT engineers, P consultants, here are the skills you need. So Maria wrote an article summarizing some of the research done by Jean Nitzke, associate professor at the University of Agder in Norway, and Sylvia Hansen Schirrer, professor at the Johannes Gutenberg University of Mainz. And they want to counter the point that kind of post-editing is like a tedious task and, you know, they want to counter that belief that it's not a very fulfilling task. They say post-editing is a complex task and a qualified post-editor needs very specific competency to be able to fulfill all the requirements of such a task. Of course, I agree. So we're highlighting three key profiles: the post-editor, the MT engineer, and the P consultant. And so the post-editor, you know, they're handling things like, of course, they have to do error output handling, like, you know, you read the output and then you handle the errors, you fix it, you maybe rewrite the odd segment. And so, of course, post-editors should be able to spot the errors in MT output. That's kind of the number one kind of challenge there. Then the MT engineer, more technologically oriented, mainly responsible for selecting and training the most suitable MT system for a particular project or client, collecting and even creating the appropriate training data. We're going to speak to Felix about that later on. And then they evaluate also the performance of MT systems. And the P consultant involves kind of assessing project requirements, analyzing risks associated with using MT systems in the post-editing workflow and communicating with all the stakeholders. So post-editor, MT engineer, P consultant, and the article really talks about all of the key skills that are required there. And it's based on really solid research from those two academics. So great write-up, Maria, and encourage everybody to head over and read that. Now, we'll head over and talk to Felix Laumann of Neuralspace about NLP.
Sounds good.
And welcome, everybody, to the second segment of the podcast. Today, we're super happy to have Felix Laumann join us today. So Felix is the CEO of Neuralspace, a natural language processing platform for low-resource languages. Hey, Felix.
Hey, Florian, really nice to meet you. Also, Esther, very nice to meet you. Thanks for inviting me.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for joining us indeed. So, Felix, where does this podcast find you today?
I'm based in London. I have been here since the beginning of the pandemic, basically. I'm still not stuck, but really enjoying, actually, London. And yeah, my team is spread out around the globe, most of them, at least. We have some people in Zurich, where you are based, Florian. We have some people in India. So yeah, have all of them.
So you haven't had an office yet, ever? Or
no, we haven't had an office yet. A virtual office, that's day one.
Any plans to ever have an office, or like, not really?
Most likely, yes. Most likely. Yeah. India has some kind of groups of people where we want to open an office in London, potentially in some time.
Yeah.
These two locations, yeah.
It's just, yeah, it's fascinating that companies get started without office. Probably you haven't seen a couple of people that are on your team ever live in person, right?
Totally, yes.
It's just crazy. So, okay, so NLP, it's not something we cover every day. It's super intriguing. And of course, it's quite key to kind of the engine of what is already and what will be the language industry. So, but first, just give us a bit of your professional background. You studied, computer science, mechanical engineering. So how did you, I wouldn't want to say end up, but how did you come across language tech and NLP? What triggered that for you?
Multiple very interesting aspects of language technology that were kind of ending up, really, that I ended up in that industry. First, that is actually not an academic motivation at all, but I've been traveling around the world quite a bit. And I found it fascinating how culture influences language, how language influences culture. And then that, like, in Indonesia, I've been, for example, there are 5 different words for ocean, right? So we have one ocean, we have sea, it's the same. Say 5 different words, ocean and rain, ocean and wind, and so on, because it's so strongly influenced in their daily life. So I found that fascinating, first of all. And then when you just look at the alphabets, right, some of them, like, look at local Indian languages, Tamil, it's like art, right? Mm. Literally art for me. It's so beautiful. When you go into Tibet, the language is extremely beautiful when you just look at it, at the alphabet and the letters. So there are different aspects that just motivate me as a person. But then when you go into kind of more taking my academic background into account, I find very interesting mathematical models powering NLP technology. So deep learning is obviously a term that everyone has heard about, but there's also lots of others which are more on a pure statistical level. And I actually have studied mathematics and statistics, so I find that very fascinating. When you can actually abstract from a world some numbers, so you represent them as a vector, and then you can actually play around with these vectors, and then in the end translate them again into words. So that entire pipeline I found also very fascinating.
It's great to hear about your sort of interest in specific languages and scripts and things like that. Tell us a bit more about your company, about Neural Space. So what is it in a nutshell? What was the origin story to founding the company, and what's your mission with the company?
So we were founded about 3 years ago now, as really when we were at the end of our master. So my two co-founders are both from India originally, came over to Germany to study the master's in computer science with me. And then we got along really well and wanted to build something in the NLP space. In the beginning, obviously, we were not really sure and we didn't really know what's the best to do, but we had always an extreme passion for low-resource languages. And low-resource languages is anything that's spoken basically in Asia and Africa, like local languages, right? And we have been then also experimenting with the very early tools that were developed by Google, by Azure, Microsoft, and AWS, and so on. And we found quite quickly, and it's more or less the same now, is that they support only a few languages, and as soon as it goes into these low-resource languages, the performance drops quite significantly. So when you just look at translation, machine translation, you have for English to French, for English to German, probably really, really accurate translations, but then do whatever, Yoruba into French, and every second word is wrong, right? So it's really a massive challenge, and we have been been passionate about that. I think we can have a massive impact when we provide technology in these languages just to the everyday life of people, right? Like, technology is all around us. If you kind of have that language barrier to use that technology, it's just a big burden for people. Yeah, and that's how we started. We then built a software developer toolkit, we call it now. It's based on APIs. It's based, you can build everything in the command line interface. We also have a web interface that's completely no code with lots of dashboards and really nice to get an overview. But it's basically a collection of functionalities within the NLP space for low resource languages.
So you mentioned many low resource languages would be found in, you know, Africa, Asia, but I mean, is there another way to define what exactly is a low resource language? How do you define it? When does a resource or when does a language no longer qualify as low resource?
The pure academic and scientific definition is such when it has a much smaller data set available. Right. So English has massive amount of data. Our data comes eventually somewhere from the internet, right? Maybe you collect tweets, maybe you collect some translations of government documents. You can do that really well, for example, in Canada, when they publish everything in French and English, you have nearly perfect translations as a data set. And this is somewhere on the internet available. And yeah, we take English is just by nature the language that is mostly represented or most predominantly represented in the internet. And this is just the top, right? And then when we work on low-resource languages, we often have 1% of the data available, or sometimes even less, 0.1%. And then it gets increasingly difficult because most of the state-of-the-art models are built for English, right? GPT-3 was a brilliant example, and so on. That's all built in English, and then people try to adapt it to low-resource languages. And this is quite difficult with so little amount of data available.
What about synthetic data? Does that hold any promise or not? Like creating, like there is a language with, you know, a decent size but still low resource, and then you somehow create synthetic data to train models, or is that not something you're looking at?
It totally eligible approach, and people have done it. We do it actually by ourselves as well. It is working. It can be used at least in neural space to create semantically similar data than we already have, right? So for example, when you say in Yoruba, you say, I would like to eat out tonight at restaurant XYZ. Then we can create 10 sentences, or at least 10. You can also create 100 similar sentences that are another person is expressing it in Yoruba the same way, but it's still going to restaurant, right? So there is some value in what we can call like really original data, just like how people interact, which then the machine can rarely replicate. It can, augment it, but not really get that original value that really human labeled or human data can have.
So you recently raised a seed round. I think it was $1.7 million. Now, two questions here. How did you connect with investors? And then maybe you spoke to a few investors. Like, what was your, 30-second pitch to them? How did you explain to them what you're trying to build in, like, the shortest amount possible so they get it?
So connecting to investors was, luckily, I think in our position, luckily not that difficult. We went through an accelerator program by TechStars before. So they really facilitate the connection to investors. They buy themselves. They also do now an additional investment in us. But then I try just to like pitch as often as I can, right? There are different events that are organized in London, online have now a couple been, and now our lead investor actually comes from Silicon Valley that we have never met in person. But they have seen me pitching at one of these events, got in touch later, and then to them, it was quite an easy pitch, I would say, because the partner was working for Google Research in the language products. So it was, he knew the issue of low resource languages quite in detail. And that's also what I pitched in my 30 seconds, that we want to be the NLP provider for low resource languages. And at the moment, we believe we can get that technology to people in the most efficient way through a developer toolkit. We may shift a bit of focus in a few years. We maybe then build more direct custom solutions. But at the moment, just like giving developers, and there are like so many, especially in India, so many developers available. When you just give them the possibility to not need to build the most complicated deep learning models to provide such a voice functionality, for example, or another functionality in NLP, then they are benefiting and they hopefully will use it.
So that also brings me to a question I wanted to ask. So right now you have kind of an MVP. You're at that stage, minimal viable product. You launched this and now you're starting to get early kind of commercial traction. So Is that correct? And then who are you getting commercial traction with, and how do they know, find you, and what are they building? Because I don't think, I mean, you probably would think you know what they're going to build, but are you surprised by what they're actually now starting to build on it? Or
by Zambia, definitely surprised. So at the moment, we give $500 free of credit. So people are just signing up, and then they get quite large allowance and can really build with it whatever they want. So customers that we target are chatbot or conversational AI development companies. And why we target specifically those is because we have seen kind of the landscape, and there's really like, it's a big player. There's Google, which is always called Dialogflow, Azure with Louis, and AWS with Lex or Comprehend. And we provide this Neuralspace with our language understanding app, quite a good alternative in my opinion. Just in terms of number of languages, so they have around 30 languages and we have 87, so nearly three times the amount of languages. That's already quite a good approach. And we've also seen people like trying to get around that language constraint with first doing translation and then analysis in English, right? So you do, for example, Yoruba to English, then analysis in English. But normally you lose some kind of information, right? So because translations are not that accurate and so on. So we do all of that natively in the 87 languages that we provide. And it gives really, really good results in terms of performance and accuracy. Yeah, and how we get to know them. Our investors are a huge help. So they definitely make plenty of introductions. We work also with some partners together who find prospects for us. We are all founders are part of communities. Maybe like Google Developer Circles. I'm here in London, part of the machine learning meetup. I'm part of PyData and so on. So you get to know people, you get to speak to them. And yeah, I hope we can fill some of their pain points.
And how do you decide which, low resource languages. How do you decide which ones to offer? Because there must be many more candidates than you're able to work on.
Totally. There are plenty, and we have really defined so far 87 based on where can we have the potentially highest impact, right? So how many speakers are in that one language, and what does it take for us to acquire data? For some, like sadly, there is, for example, Wolof in Senegal, which we would love to offer. We don't at the moment because we can't find any data. We need to data needs to be collected for us. Either we do it by ourselves or we work with a data acquisition partner.
I know some organizations in Senegal. It's funny you mentioned Wolof because my mum lived there for 2 years. So I visited a few times. It's really fascinating, the language and everything that's on offer there. But
but then we looked at like where are most speakers, and like just automatically you draw attention a bit on India, right? Because it's like 1.3 billion. Mm. But then even in India, we have now 12 languages. We also offer something which is called Hinglish or Benglish. So they mix up Hindi and English, right? You've maybe seen that in the Arabic-speaking world, it's called Arabisi. So they mix up Arabic and English or Arabic and French sometimes. I think in African countries, maybe also people used to speak that way. Mm. But that's also something what we see huge traction on and people really like.
And that's, I would assume, also some kind of competitive advantage over the Dialogflows and AWSs of this world, right? Because you could, I mean, theoretically go to Dialogflow, but then if your language isn't there, then, well, what are you going to do? Write an email to Google? Probably not. Yeah, so exactly, is that the key at this point in time, the key competitive advantage, or are you seeing other things that are really differentiating you from those big tech solutions?
The number of languages, definitely. And also then when Dialogflow, for example, offering Finnish, we have seen now recently being added, also the accuracy on that language, right? Because all our models are built with the sole purpose of fitting well to low-resource languages. And I believe the big tech are more taking the opposite approach. They build something for English and then try to adapt it to the other languages. Mm. And we kind of take exactly the opposite approach and want to, like, low-resource language first. English is in the end also there, but yeah, it's the model is not meant to be the best one in English.
So just within this framework and the focus on NLP, I mean, does machine translation fit into the framework and what you're focusing on in any way, and how so?
Definitely. So machine translation is also one app or one feature on our platform. We have been using it in connection with others. So there's one brilliant example that we had being designed by a customer, which was very interesting, is that they built the language understanding capabilities, which are in the end used by a chatbot in English. But then they also, none of their team members spoke a foreign language by themselves, or at least not the language that they want to cover. And then they use the translation feature to do what we call 1-to-100 chatbot. So you design it in one language and then you apply it like to 100 languages. For us, it was something like 90 languages. But they did then like the translation of their data with the machine translation app on our platform, and then had it quite easily available to offer chatbots in many more languages.
Tell us more about, let's say, India and chatbots. What are you seeing actual use cases being built? Like, is it like just e-commerce website, somebody asks something and you take the first kind of triage of what a person wants, or what are some other use cases you're seeing being built?
A lot, actually, what we don't do in Europe, but what I call, or very rarely do, but what are WhatsApp chatbots. So you see that a lot I think I haven't seen it in Europe, but in India and other Asian countries, it's hugely popular. So you have even a doctor, like a GP, literally, offering a chatbot to book an appointment, right? And maybe also do some basic symptoms checker, because people are very often, like, mobile network is more or less like everywhere, also in India, but then maybe not the strongest, right? So you can't, maybe it's just not sufficient to go onto a website, and then maybe the website's only in English and so on, right? So they offer very often a chatbot for a business or for a GP or something else. What we've also seen, which was actually a government project in India, it was not built with us, but one of our really close partners, was offering a COVID vaccination booking system through WhatsApp. So it was also a chatbot. And then they offered to book your COVID vaccination, and you saw automatically the dates that are available and so on. And then you could have it booked through that.
Is this mostly text-based, or can you also do voice to text and then people like interact using their voice, because maybe there's some people that, or some of these languages can't even type, or you can type, but people struggle typing?
Yeah. These use cases that I mentioned, they were all purely text-based. We want to get to the level of voice, right? There is, I kind of dream of that little merchants on the street in India have either a phone, though most of them have a smartphone, which is very interesting. But then they can say, please transfer 5 rupees to that and then that person, right? So it would be ideal to get to that level where different dialects are understood, and where then maybe in the beginning, little voice commands can actually be directly taken forward to do some actions.
And that is mostly in WhatsApp now. So you don't see any of the other chat apps, or maybe Facebook chat, but yeah.
There are plenty of others. Facebook, I think, I don't see that much traction for WhatsApp. Not see that much traction on Messenger than I see on WhatsApp. But people also use it like on their website, right? Very often in the right bottom, you see kind of a chatbot popping up, right? I also know one other company that have done a lot on customer call centers. So they actually did first like a voice, an artificial voice that is helping you with an FAQs, and then maybe you're forwarded to a real person if the issue is too complicated. But yeah, even that voice command that can already handle a lot.
And out of India, I mean, obviously the region of that everyone's looking at is Ukraine at the moment. Is that a language you currently offer? And are you seeing additional activity right now? Because, I mean, I've never used machine translation in my life as much as I do right now when I machine translate tweets, right, with Google Translate. Are you seeing something there as well?
We do offer the language. We don't have any projects at the moment being built on Neurospace in Ukraine. We would love to, obviously. I've been thinking about like what we could do, right? And there are even there are plenty of actually low resource languages in Ukraine as well. I think people have something like 20 regional languages. They are very often like dialects, or so, right? They're maybe not purely different languages, but it would be interesting, right? Like lots of people are maybe like stuck in the village at the moment, right? And then try to get some help.
Got it. Let's talk about the how you could go about collecting the data. So how does that work? How do you, let's say, Wolof, like if you decided to go there, how would you go about this? Like you talk to somebody at the university, you go to a company. How do you source that kind of data if it's not freely available on the internet?
Yeah. So Ben, at the moment, we work mostly with data acquisition companies. So they have their own process, but we can design these processes quite strongly. So what we want is everyday conversations, mostly conversations because they're valuable, because it's chatbot or voice bot, right? It's always really valuable. Conversations where people really interact in the kitchen, in the extreme case, right? Like really where you get to know, where nobody tries to speak a very good language, or where nobody tries to build proper sentences. Like, should really be everyday conversations. Which are obviously difficult to get, but we have our recording. Our data acquisition company has some recording tools, and they try to do that. What we have been also thinking about, haven't done yet, is actually working directly with linguistic professionals, and then let them read a certain text that covers different pronunciations and different emphasis and maybe even emotions, right? So you can, for example, give the reader some instructions. Please read that section in a very excited tone. Because we are also thinking of something which is called text-to-speech. So we actually want to produce some real speech output to some kind of text input, which is at the moment a bit boring, in my opinion, when you take the big tech provider. Mm. So it's like, hello, Florian, how are you today? Right? It's so neutral. It's so flat and neutral. So we would like to add some kind of spice to that, right?
That's interesting. I mean, coming back to neural space and your own team, as we know, there's a lot of demand, so much demand for experienced developers in the areas of machine learning, deep learning, et cetera, in NLP. I mean, how are you finding it kind of competing for talent in those areas? How do you, what's the pitch? What do you offer to your kind of new or potential recruits?
You're very right, Esther. It's a huge race, and it's kind of the uptake in remote work, American companies suddenly offer African employees, suddenly offer Indian employees a very, very high-paid job, which we can't compete with. So it is tricky. We have done a couple of decisions based on that mostly, and also why we believe that it's close to our value. So we offer every employee equity of the company. Doesn't matter really on what level. If they directly come out of university, they will get equity. If they have 10 years of experience, they will get also equity. It's not always the same amount, but there is some kind of bond that we want to establish to the company, and it's obviously vesting over some period of time. Otherwise, we really have, it's a lot about culture, and that's also what people like working with us. So there's overall a quite flat hierarchy. We do really set learning as the number one criteria what we want to achieve all by ourselves. So it's totally fine when you do mistakes, but you should try to learn from that. And that's especially valuable for the ones who just joined from university, right? Because for them, it's a huge pressure in the first moment, and then we always come and say, hey, we're here to learn. We give you enough time, and so on. And you can feel safe with us. We are definitely not thinking that you directly need to produce. We always want to invest by ourselves as well. But it is tricky. We had bad experience that someone confirmed first that they joined, and later on, a week before they were supposed to join, they cancelled again. Mm. I think that can happen at the moment. The people who, once they join, they normally stay very long because they really enjoy the work atmosphere. It's a race at the moment.
How specialized are they, or how, when they join you, do they typically already have a PhD in that field, or is it still kind of their path would be wide open to go into any kind of ML area, or how specific would that profile already be?
So far, we haven't hired anyone with a PhD. Two of our founders have PhDs, or on the way to have a PhD. And we generally try to communicate and give that knowledge forward as much as we can. We do see, or we want that people have previous NLP experience. Right. So even if they have had some kind of projects, they need to have done in NLP. because otherwise it's just extremely difficult to pick up. And like the pace of research is also very fast, right? So when you start kind of studying NLP, when you start working with us, I don't know if you will ever like catch up in the next 4 months, right? So you need to have some previous NLP experience. We also have hired platform engineers, right, who are just like the pure experts in Microsoft Azure, who know exactly how to scale and so on. But even them, we require some machine learning knowledge, because like these models in the end need to scale to thousands of users. But yeah, it's not that easy also to find those people. Like the platform engineers are extremely in demand, I think.
Just broader NLP space, like what are some of the cool things you're thinking are coming out in the next 2-3 years? What are the most kind of exciting research areas? You said research changes all the time. For us, it's super hard because we never know. It's happening so quickly. What do you see as kind of the exciting areas?
I find one particular idea that actually depends on lots of smaller achievements, but I would like to have live-to-live voice translation. Yeah. Or like voice-to-voice live translations, right? Mm. And that's something what I'm hugely fascinated about. There are companies, for example, in Rome Translated, who has done something in that direction. But I find that extremely, extremely fascinating, because it also depends technologically on so many different levels, right? You need to have a nearly perfect speech-to-text, you need to have a nearly perfect translation, and then you need to have, again, a nearly perfect text-to-speech. So you don't have like a lame and neutral language, a neutral voice. So you want to have like some excitement and so on. What the original input was. So that would be fascinating if you can have that, maybe even like on what is called on edge, right? So without internet connection. Mm. That's like actually a different field, but I also find it quite fascinating, where people try not to build the largest language model that can possibly exist. They try to get very high performance on tiny models that can fit on a mobile device, can fit into a car computer, and doesn't need to have internet connection to actually work, right? So what happens at the moment, when you use Siri on your phone, it directly goes to the web, right? It goes to a cloud, it's processed there because there's a massive language model behind, and then it goes back. So it's just, your phone is just a kind of a transfer agent. But if all the computation could be done on the mobile phone itself, I think it would be terrific. And like, so open up so many use cases, right? Like data privacy concerned customers would be more happy to use it and so on.
And what's on the roadmap for you and neural space in the next, you know, year and a half?
So we are not there yet to build that like speech-to-speech live translation, but we really want to build a neural space platform to cover nearly any fundamental NLP project or NLP problem. And then our idea is, so we generally see the different apps on the neural space platform as building blocks, right? And they can be combined in different ways to build an end solution. For us, at the moment, we have our first language understanding app live on the platform. We want to add speech capabilities in Q2. So we have maybe not all 87, but maybe something like 40 to 50 languages for speech to text. And then we also invest quite a bit in what's called auto NLP. So there's basically customization of some kind of these NLP functionalities for your data set. And we can already do that for language understanding, but for speech, also Google doesn't allow that at the moment. So we want that you can upload, either you go to our platform, you say, okay, I'm saying now 10 different words with my voice and maybe about a topic that I find interesting. And then this entire model should adapt and should be kind of customized for you, right? So that would also be extremely fascinating.
Yeah.
And yeah, there's just these fundamental building blocks at the moment. And we later on think about what we call meta apps. So for example, that voice-to-voice translation.
Meta apps. Well, thank you so much for taking the time. That was illuminating. I love this space. I love this NLP. And we are glad to have you on. We learned a lot. Hope our listeners as well.
Yeah, thanks, Felix. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Bye-bye.